This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I want to try to find a way to go as quickly as possible from early stuff to later stuff. Trying to show in the way how one kind of thing, how writing became work with body, became performance, in turn then became design. Work started for me as writing. When I was writing, I think I was trying to do maybe what words can't do. I wanted words to be matter. I wanted words to be material. I wanted words not so much that you saw it through. I wanted words that you could look at, stop at. When I was writing, the way I began a piece was always what they questioned: how do I move? How do I move from left margin of the page to right margin, from top of the page to bottom? So the attempt was to do something on the page as literal as possible. A poem that starts with a period, then playing on the word point. I have made my point. I make it again. It. Now you get the point. Again, always trying to do something as a fact, something as literal as possible. On the one hand, there is a finger. On the one hand, there is another finger, another finger, another finger. Obviously five times. An attempt to do a poem that could possibly write itself, starting with the phrase "let it go," going to the dictionary, then writing down each word after the word "go" until I reach the end of the page, the bottom of the page. Probably the last piece of mine that I thought of was a poem done in 1969. Consisting of a book on reading speed, how to improve reading speed. And the title given to the piece was "The Time Taken for Me to Walk from Such and Such a Street, Such and Such a Time, to Such and Such a Street, Such and Such a Time." So in other words, an attempt to make reading time equivalent to experiential time. By the time I got to that point, it was clear to me that now that I had written myself onto the street, I couldn't go back. So in 1969, context changed. No longer writing context, but art context. Why art context? Because at that time, I think what drew a lot of the fact that art seemed to present itself as a kind of non-field. Art was a field that had no inherent characteristics of its own, except for the fact that it was called art. So art was a field into which you could import from other fields, from psychology, from sociology, from history, from news. When I started, starting to think in that, I took a lot of walks, walked the city using a camera, going through some actions while holding the camera while touching my toes. Reach my hands above me, snap photo one, bring hands down to my toes, photo two, holding a camera while going through the motion of throwing a ball, reaching my hands behind me, starting to throw, click photo one, go through a throwing motion, follow through motion, click for. The attempt was an attempt to take, not so much to take a photo of an action, but trying to convince myself that maybe I could take a photo through an action. The act of touching my toes, the act of throwing a ball could result in a photo, could produce a photo. The constant attempt was, now that I don't ask anymore, how do I connect myself with the world around me? How do I connect myself with the space around me? 1969 piece done for a program called Street Works. in which a number of people were asked to do a piece over the period of a month involving the street, specifically New York streets. The piece I did had a very simple scheme. Each day for the month, I would pick out at random a person in the street, a person walking. Each day, then, I would follow a different person each day until that person entered a private place. So that following episodes ranged from 2 or 3 minute episodes when someone might get and follow, ranging from that to, say, 7 or 8 hour episodes. A person would go to a restaurant, a movie, etc. Okay, with regard to the question I had at that time was, now that I'm in real space, what gives me a reason to move there? Doing pieces with schemes like this, doing pieces with the scheme of following a person, took time and space out of my hands. Be tied into another person's time and space. I could be carried along by another person, almost literally dragged by another person. Okay, starting in 69, then I was using my own person in pieces. The reason for using my own person was once I realized I wasn't writing anymore, I could obviously choose some kind of medium that would act as a replacement for writing. I could pick some kind of ground that would act as a replacement for the page. But I probably realized then that if I had gotten to the point where the page didn't seem useful anymore, then I could probably, whatever medium I chose, whatever ground I chose, I would eventually get to the point where that didn't seem useful anymore. So it seemed to make sense, rather than pick another medium, a medium that I would have to eventually let go, it seemed to make more sense, rather than concentrate on the ground that was being worked on, focus from ground that was worked on to myself, to instrument who could use whatever ground happened to be available at the time, whatever ground happened to be convenient at the time. After doing pieces like this throughout 1969, it started to occur to me that something was wrong. Maybe I was cheating. In pieces, but I wasn't really making enough use of the personness of my person. So it seemed to me that if I was going to go on using my own person in pieces, I'd better start focusing on that person. Maybe backtrack a little bit. If a language could be applied to this early work, the language would be something like I, a person, an agent, attend to it, considered as if it's out there. How do I key myself into that world? How do I tie myself into that world? Gradually, though, it seemed that maybe instead of focusing on it, a world that's considered as if it's out there, I have to start focusing on me. This started to happen with some pieces in 1970. pieces that involved turning in on myself, or maybe more exactly, more precisely, turning on myself. I start in action. The action ends in me. The pieces all involve concentration. The starting point was, how do I prove both to myself and others that I'm concentrating on myself? One obvious way is to do something physical to myself. Apply some physical stress to my body. Applying physical stress to my body possibly leads to me adapting to that stress. Maybe leads to me changing because of that stress. One example, a long film called Conversions. Film begins in darkness. There's a light moving around on the screen. The light is a candle that I'm moving around my body. As I draw the candle near to my chest, the camera zooms in, and the rest of part one of the film is spent in me using the candle, the light source for the film, using the candle to burn the hair off each breast. Once the hair is removed, pulling at each breast in a kind of futile attempt to develop a woman's... the notion of futility was probably really, really important here. Obviously, I could find some easier way to look like a woman. The fact that I didn't do that probably meant that I wanted to concentrate on the process of trying to be a woman. In retrospect, these pieces in 70 probably put me in the position of a kind of little engine that could. No matter how hard, no matter how long I pulled at my breast, it wasn't going to happen. But I could tell myself that I think I could, I think I can, I think I can. One of the starting points for these pieces was that if I made myself vulnerable, maybe a viewer had some way into my space. If I made myself vulnerable, there could be more coincidence between a viewer space and my space. After doing pieces like this for a while, I realized that the pieces were doing exactly the opposite of what I thought I was opening myself up to viewers. I was probably closing myself off in the sense that the pieces were all involved with a kind of self-enclosed activity. I start an action that ends in me. So I'm making a kind of closed circle around myself. The viewer is always an outsider. The viewer is always outside this circle. He's a voyeur looking in on some secret, looking in on something that he or she shouldn't see, that he or she shouldn't be part of. So I thought I had to try to break that circle. The first attempt was some pieces in 1971 using Mickey, but another person. This was a 1971 piece called Security Zone, a piece done specifically with a person that I didn't trust. This person and I were alone on a pier. I was blindfolded and earplugs, hands tied behind my back. So the only person I could, the only way I wasn't going to walk off the pier was to trust this person and depend on this person to keep me from walking off the pier. After doing pieces like this for a while, I started to think it was a kind of sidestep. I was marking time. If what bothered me was the closed circle that a viewer was outside of, this didn't. It only made the circle bulge. I concentrate on him or her while he or she concentrates on me. This mutual concentration makes a closed circle around the two of us. The viewer again is away. The viewer again is a voyeur. Gradually, it became clear that I had to find some way to approach a viewer. This started to happen. This started to happen in 71. This was a piece towards the end of 1971 called Claim, a two-level space, street level and basement. As viewers came into the space on street level, there's a video monitor next to a door that goes down. So the video monitor acts as a kind of announcement to viewers, maybe a kind of warning to viewers. Seeing and hearing what's going on by means of the video monitor, a person decides whether or not to open the door, come downstairs. The piece is a three-hour piece. I'm seated on a chair at the foot of the stairs in the basement. I'm blindfolded, lead pipes and a crowbar. The 3 hours are spent in me constantly talking aloud, but talking directed to myself, saying things like, I'm alone here in the basement. I want to stay alone here in the basement. I don't want anybody to come down in the basement with me. I'll stop anybody from coming down in the basement with me. I'm alone here in the basement. In other words, using talk, self-hypnotizing device, using talk as a way to convince myself that this basement is mine, so that whenever I hear someone come down the stairs, I can swing the lead pipe, swing the crowbar in front of me, as the title of the piece says, claiming this space. I mean, in retrospect, this piece was probably a big me. It was like making myself into a kind of private house. I'm protecting my property. Obviously, I didn't think that way then. What I did think then was that what I liked about these pieces, what attracted me to these pieces, was that they started me thinking of art as an art as an occasion of some kind of exchange system, art as an occasion where a person in the role of artist comes face to face with person in the role of viewer. So in other words, what interested me was the I face you quality of the pieces. But a number of things started to bother me about the pieces. The fact that in all these I, you pieces, I set myself up on a still point in the space. A viewer is asked to go through the space. In other words, in this piece, a person is asked to go through lead pipes, to go through crowbars in order to get to setting up a situation of meeting, but a meeting should be between equals. And it started to be clear that maybe all I was doing was confirming an art world hierarchy in which the artist is on a higher plane than viewers, in which viewers have to struggle in order to get to the art. In other words, everything I thought I hated about art as religion, artwork as altar, artist as, it seemed to me that my work was possibly not just confirming, but enhancing. So there had to be some way out of that. And it seemed to me that the problem was a problem of focus. As soon as people entered this space, I was the focal point. I was the target. What if I wasn't the target? What if instead of being a point on the space, I started to become part of the space? What if I started thinking that way? Thinking like that led to a piece in the beginning of 1972, conventional gallery space, about 25 feet wide, about 45 feet long. Halfway across the floor, the floor rises and becomes a ramp that goes 3 feet at the far wall. The ramp is a continuation of the floor. The piece is done for a number of days over a two-week period. Each day, the piece is activated or performed in from opening time of the gallery to closing time, so from 10 in the morning to 6. Viewer comes into the space, walks across without thinking about it so much, walks across the ramp. I'm underneath the ramp, underneath the floor, underneath the space where viewers are walking. I'm trying to constantly masturbate, and in order to do so, I can use viewers as help. Help in the sense that I hear viewers' footsteps on top of me. I can build sexual footsteps. Those sexual fantasies can keep my activity going, keep my masturbation going. Every now and then, the masturbation reaches climax. Viewer on top of the floor might be thinking something like, oh, he's done this with me. He's done this for me. One factual thing I didn't mention, constantly coming up from the floor is a voice, my voice saying things like, I'm doing this with the person on my left, I'm touching your hair, I'm running my hand down your back, etc. Okay, a few things, two or three things to say about Seedbed. I mentioned that it was done for a number of days from 10 o'clock in the morning to 6. I mentioned that not so much endurance test quality of the piece, though, like it or not, it became that. It was kind of like an eight-hour job for that period. Each day, I knew what my task was. I knew what I had to do. But the reason for the eight-hour day, at least the way I saw it, was that if this piece made any sense, its sense had to do in taking architecture. Something, though, I'm not sure how much I used the word architecture then, but taking a room, taking walls and floor, especially floor, taking things that you assume are neutral, and trying to fill this space with person. In other words, I had to be part of the floor. I had to be part of the floor if the viewer knew it. I had to be part of the floor before the first viewer entered the gallery at the beginning of the day. I had to remain part of the floor when the last viewer left that night. Seedbed raised some questions to me. The biggest question was, now that I wasn't seen in the space, be there. And I think this was a reflection of a larger question about the validity of live performance. I think I was starting to think at this time that the way I was using live performance, in the sense that it was connected to a previous decade. The reason I did performance was that I thought the time was doing performance. Neil Young, my influences at that time were Neil Young, Van Morrison, single voice, long song, single voice needing this long song as a way to meander around the self. I mean, the interesting thing about that time is that most of the music was country music. Yeah. Long time to meander in. It wasn't always. I mean, in the middle of Neil Young, Van Morrison, there was the introduction of the Velvet Underground, which was a very different kind of music. Suddenly the city appeared. Suddenly there wasn't time to meander around the self. Suddenly there was the pressure of things around. There was the pressure of space around. But that's a side thought. I mean, although maybe I should mention as a kind of main thought, that music has always been probably a major influence on stuff I've done. I think my stuff has always worked best when I've connected to a particular kind of pop music at the time. The music I listen to obviously changes, you know. When I was doing stuff involved with my own person, yes, I was listening to single voice. Pieces were no longer live performances. They were installations. My music had changed. I was listening to the Ramones, the Sex Pistols, no longer single voice, mass voice. The kind of music we listen to at the studio now is probably for the first time in my life, not so much a concentration on vocal music that acts as a kind of surrounding. I'm probably rushing this thought, but music and architecture, I think, are inherently connected. Architecture has nothing to do with sculpture, but everything to do with music. Both architecture and music make a surrounding, make an ambience. With both architecture and music, you're meant to do what you can do while listening to music. You're obviously meant to do other things while in the middle of architecture. So I think the keynote of music in the 21st century is that of music and architecture in the 21st century is that it's about multi-focus. And I think anything that we do now demands multi-focus. It's harder to read now. You can have a lot of books, but you don't necessarily read them from beginning to end. I would find it so much easier to see a movie if a movie was projected in the street. You know, if I could see a movie while going somewhere. But again, skipping ahead too far. So I started to think that my stuff was too late. My stuff was connected to another time. It was connected to the 60s. It was connected to the language of finding oneself, as if the self is a kind of precious jewel that happens to be lost somewhere. And it was 1972, 73, 74, and a lot of other people were starting to have very different notions of the self. Self wasn't this thing that you could concentrate on. Self wasn't this thing that you could separate from the rest of the person. Maybe self existed only as part of a social system, a political system. So I wanted work of mine to connect with those overall systems. And I thought maybe the only way I could do that was I had to get rid of myself. So by the mid-70s, pieces were no longer performances, were no longer actions. They were installations. Installations was a very vague term then. Now, I think those of us who were doing what other people were calling installations probably tried to give some kind of specific meaning to the word. The way I saw installation was that a space was given to me, a museum space or a gallery space was given to me for a certain period of time. At that time, I didn't have a piece in place. until I had a place to do a piece in, so that I would try to orient the piece to this specific space. Why was site specificity so important to me? Probably because I wanted desperately to document as a marginal note that art couldn't be universal. That art made sense only at this particular space, in this particular space, at this particular time. In another space, at another time, either it would make no sense or a different sense. Important to me about installations was a gallery or museum space was a place where people came, so that people had to be part of the piece I was doing. One example of installations was a 1976 piece called "Where We Are Now" (). Who are we? You enter the gallery usually at the around the corner of this black room at the right of the image. So you walked along a kind of L-shaped corridor that took you to what was usually used as the main room of the gallery. This room at the right. For the occasion of this show, the outside of the room was painted black. The doorway was blocked off. Next to this black room is a long table, long wooden plank, stools on either side of the table. The table is propped up on of the gallery, and then continues out the gallery, so that what started as a table becomes a diving board. Or the way I saw it, whether anybody else saw it this way or not, the way to settle in at the gallery maybe should become the way to leave the gallery, get out of the gallery. All the pieces of the mid-70s used. In this case, there was a hanging audio speaker above the table. There's a constant clock ticking. As the clock is ticking, voice comes in, my voice comes in. Now that we're all here together, and what do you think, Bob? Now that we've gone as far as we can go, and what do you think, Barbara? Now that we're satisfied, now that we know. In other words, the audio tape was in the guise of calling a community meeting to order. What I liked about this piece was that it was an attempt to treat a gallery or museum space as if it was a town square. At the same time that I liked that, I had a very large nagging doubt. I started to tell myself that I'm kidding myself. A gallery or museum is never going to be a town square. It's never going to be a plaza. It's never going to be a public space. If I really want a public space, I'd better find a way to get there. It was the installations of the mid-70s that started me thinking that I really couldn't do stuff in an art context anymore. I wanted a public space. I knew that there were certain disciplines that already worked with that space. There was architecture. There was landscape architecture. So in the beginning of the 80s, I had pieces that tried to kind of redo architecture for myself. My stuff had always been connected with body, with person. How could I turn architecture into a kind of game that a person could use? How could I make the person the cause of architecture? So in the beginning of the 80s, there were a number of pieces consisting of it that a person could use. The use of the instrument or vehicle made some kind of shelter, made some kind of structure. That shelter carried a sign. One example, 1980 piece called Instant House. Four panels, American flag covered on the floor, a swing in the middle. If a person sits in the swing, the swing down, and these panels start to come up. the panels start to rise, becoming the walls of an Instant House. And the Instant House is an American American flag house inside Soviet flag house outside. So you make one kind of space for yourself, another kind of space as an announcement for others. Off the swing, the house goes down to its original position. So what interested me was the house only lasts, the architecture only exists as long as a person keeps the instrument going. At the same time, that's what I liked about those pieces. I'm spending all this effort making attempts at house building, but there's no house left. There's no house left to use. So by the mid-80s, pieces became more quote permanent. You could go back to them. If pieces like Instant House were a kind of rehearsal for setting up a kind of game of architecture. In the middle of the 80s, I was trying to make kinds of prototype architecture for myself. My version of the prototype house was a 1984 piece called Bad Dream House. Three upside-down houses, two upside-down houses tilted against each other so that they support a third upside-down house. You enter at either end at the open gable. Or you sit at or walk past an upside down table, or you could go upstairs to what used to be the underside of the house. Now that the house is upside down, it's a facing set of seats or bleachers, or you could go further upstairs to the glass house, transparent, some opaque, some mirrored. At the same time that I wanted to make a kind of prototype house, I needed to make a prototype landscape. Same year, a piece called Face of the Earth. From afar, it looked like an artificial hedge. As you come closer, it's a face-shaped platform. The features of the face become seating places for people. It was around that time, I think, by the mid-80s, especially the end of the 80s, I became convinced that my stuff probably wasn't art anymore, and I had to change the way I work any longer as a single person, single agent. I had to work as part of a group of people. I had to work as part of a group of architects for two basic reasons. Number one, I wanted to do architecture, but I really didn't know how. So I needed to have people around me who did know how. There was a just as important reason, probably, part of a group of people. I started to become convinced then that if you did something privately, if you did something alone, it could probably never be public. If something started private, possibly it ended private. If you really wanted something to end up as public, it probably had to at least semi-public, quasi-public. And public probably starts with the number three. One is a solo, two is a couple or a mirror image. The third person starts an argument, and public probably starts when an argument starts. So by the end of the 80s, a country studio started. Now, years later, I have real regrets that I gave the studio my own name. I thought at that time that I was too much a known quantity, so I couldn't get rid of my name. I wish now I had done what a lot of architecture studios that were forming then, Asymptote, Foreign Office Architects, UN Studio, another name. It might not be too late, but I can't think of the right name. Or I shouldn't say I can't think of the right name, because the studio has talked about a new name for a long time, but... Even though sometimes we take endless amounts of time doing a project, we take even more endless amounts of time trying to figure out a good name. When the studio started, because obviously I didn't have any reputation in an architecture context, the kinds of projects we were basically asked to do were not what I think of as real architecture projects, but instead so-called public art projects. And public art projects exist mainly as a result of 1% for art laws. When a public building is built, 1% of the budget, 1% of the budget is spent on architecture. Because in the 90s, most of the projects we did were public art projects. We developed some public art projects exist for a particular building, whether that building is built or designed. So some of our methods were oriented towards ways to key into a building, ways to key into an already existent building, quirk in the space. Can you tie into that quirk? This was a project done in 1995 at Queens College in New York. The site is a kind of pass-through space in front of the English department at Queens College. On either side of the stairway leading building is a pedestal on top of which is a 3-foot diameter concrete sphere. The 3-foot diameter concrete spheres were our starting points. Starting points in the sense that the concrete spheres seemed to be trying to make an extra grandiose entrance out of what was only the entrance to an English department building. On the other hand, the concrete sphere lost inside the overall space. So our attempt was to fit the existing spheres inside a field of spheres. So we added more spheres. Spheres ranging from 1 foot in diameter, going through the existing 3-foot diameter concrete spheres, going through spheres 12 feet in diameter. So the spheres are cut into, so you can walk between halves of a sphere. You could sit inside a sphere. As it becomes night, light comes out from inside the sphere. So what used to be a kind of pass-through space has become more of a gathering space. I admit the kind of nagging doubt I have about these pieces is, could a couple of folding chairs have done the same thing? And I'm not sure of the answer. Sorry. Around that time, though, just one comment about at that time, probably because that's all we were asked to do was public art projects, I was trying to give myself a real reason to do public art. And I thought the reason was that because 1% for art laws meant that because the art costs so much less than the public art comes in from the outside, comes in from the margins. And I thought that maybe if you come in from the margins, maybe you can become some kind of representative of possibly a minority culture. Public art isn't spent as much attention to as the architecture. Maybe you could sneak something in. At that time, the way I tried, if architecture is built, it's probably built because it's been allowed to be built. It's been allowed to be built because somehow or other it advances the institution. It advances an existing power. Maybe if you come in from the side, you can nudge into that. I've been trying to do public art projects for a while. I think I've become convinced that the 1% for art laws, another way of putting it is that the art is worth 1% of the architecture. So I wonder if public art can ever be more than a folly. At the same time, in the 90s, we had some opportunities to work on some stuff that may be later work. This was the site of a museum piece we did in 1993 for a museum of applied art in Vienna. We were given the central exhibition hall to work with, and what our project consisted of was taking the existing central exhibition hall, making a replica of the central exhibition hall, seeing the replicated room from one corner of the actual room. So when you entered the room, you were walking, you're walking under the falling skylight, the skylight of the falling room. You're sandwiched between skylight of falling room, skylight of rising room. I just want to go through this quickly. There's a tree that goes through the skylight of the rising room, goes through the skylight of the falling room, then goes up and into the existent skylight, goes through the glass of the existent skylight. I think pieces like this gave us more of a feeling of, you know, any project we're given has a site. What can we do with the site? Do we have to add anything new to the site? Maybe we can take the site as it exists and twist the site, turn the site upside down. The same year, 1993, a country studio worked with Stephen Hall of an alternative gallery space in New York, storefront for art and architecture. We wanted to renovate the space. We had a very small budget. Luckily, maybe for us, storefront was a very narrow space. It's about 15 feet. It's about 85, 90 feet long. At its widest point, it narrows at the other end to 5 feet wide. So we started to think, maybe in order to renovate the space, all we have to do is renovate the wall. So we made a new front for storefront, a new facade for storefront. The facade was made in segments. The segments can pivot. The segments pivot horizontally, some vertically. So if a wall segment pivots horizontally, it makes a table. It makes a chair. You could sit on the chair. You can show a model. Show a sculpture on the table. A little earlier, we worked on a kind of mobile project. It was done for a museum show. It was done in 1991. It's a piece called Mobile Linear City. Consists of a tractor and trailer, so it can be driven wherever you want. The trailer acts as a container for when you park it where you want to, you can now pull out four other units from the existing trailer. So what started as a space about 15 feet long ends up as a space about 75 feet long. The corrugated walls have hinged a section down and in to make a table, a bench, a shelf, a bed. What I want to do for the rest of the talk is talk about try to give an introduction to what the studio is doing now. The way the studio doesn't work is I have everybody else carries it out. The way the studio does work is maybe I start a project off sometimes, not all the time, with a kind of general idea, general method. I think I've learned during the years that if I do something well, it's probably I can maybe devise overall structures. I don't look at details. I can devise overall schemes. But the way the studio works is maybe I start a project off with an overall scheme, then we talk together, we argue together, we draw together, whatever. Eventually, it's difficult, it's impossible to tell where did the... I don't know if I can really say that six people think better than one, but they certainly think more than one. And I think the thinking more than one is really important. Because there's always a second thought. There's always another way to do something. And I think I've become convinced over the years that I think I want our projects to have, because if a project has loose ends, other people can come in and do something with it. One thing I think that gradually drew me to architecture away from art is that architecture always has built into it the realization of the necessity for renovation. every architect realizes that this building isn't going to be good for a long time. It has extra. Architecture seems to recognize time, recognizing changing time. Maybe that's an advantage of architecture. One of the disadvantages of architecture is that it takes too long to do. So that architecture is probably always outdated. You have an idea of what might be appropriate for this particular place at this particular time. The project is built, 5 years have passed, 7 years have passed. Probably, hopefully, the city has changed by that time. So you're already out of date. Partially because of my background, the way we think of spaces, I think we think of spaces not so much as nodes, but as circulation routes. We think of spaces as perform action spaces. Maybe because we think of spaces as action spaces, the way we tend to work is we start, at least in the back of our mind, with a number of operations we can exert on a site, on a situation. I want to go through some of those operations, giving as an example. A project might be shown partially as a demonstration of one operation. Then it'll come back later. Operation number one: make a world, then poke a hole in the world. An architecture of holes. This is a coffee and tea set we started to do a few years ago. Alessi was going to do it; they never did. What Alessi wanted was 4 units, coffee, tea, milk, and sugar, and a tray. We thought maybe there's something wrong with the program. It shouldn't need a tray. If we did it well enough, maybe it would make its own tray. And also we thought Alessi left out cups and saucers. So we started with a general sphere, then took away parts of the sphere until all that was left was 4 units, coffee, tea, milk, and sugar, and transparent connectors. This project will come back later. Another example of an architecture of holes was a proposal we made for a new World Trade Center. We proposed a World Trade Center full of holes. Our starting point was that if a building nowadays is going to be exploded anyway, maybe a building nowadays should come pre-exploded, already exploded. So we took the original site of the World Trade Center, extruded it to a height of 110 stories high. So now it's more of a volume than the original World Trade Center ever was. So we have more private office space than anybody could possibly need. So we can shoot cones through it, riddling this building with holes. It can act as a kind of urban camouflage. A terrorist flying by above might look down and say, "Oh, we don't have to buy. We don't. It's already been dealt with." This project too comes back later. Operation number two: overlay, screen, camouflage, a second skin. This was the site of a clothing store we did in 2003 for a group of designers in New York called United Bamboo, first clothing store in Tokyo. This was the building that they were given. The United Bamboo story. The United Bamboo people were somewhat worried that this is a modular system that in Japan is conventionally used for houses, for residences. So the United Bamboo people were afraid that this was never going to look like a store. It was always going to look like a house. The first step was to screen the building, screen it with a kind of metal mesh. The glass facades then can push in or bulge out between the metal mesh. Another example of camouflage is a large project we're working on now for the north of France, for Saulnes-sur-Mer. It's a site of a very large fishing port. The city is worried that nobody knows the fishing port. It's not a place where tourists go. It's not a place where inhabitants of the city go. So they've asked us to think about some kind of visitor's trajectory through the port. For example, they say people go through the port, they don't know what buildings are. People don't know where to walk. So one thing we're working on is a kind of walkway system, a kind of canopy system. the canopy system, besides setting up a walkway, can also now provide captions. It can provide words, so you can look through the canopy, through the wall beside you, to a fishing boat, to a building. The canopy comes down and makes seating. Operation number three, bubble, wave, bulge, ooze, and architectural flow. Back to the United Bamboo store. I didn't mention that how the upper floor works, the screen on the floor. The clothing store occupies the ground floor, offices on the upper floor. On the bulging facade of the upper floor, there's a projection screen, and the way it works is when you're inside the store, if you're trying on United Bamboo clothes, if you like the way you look, you can press a button at the mirror, and you become the model for the United Bamboo clothes. We tried to make a clothing store that was as soft as clothing, as soft as skin. So the material we used was PVC. Material that's usually used for projection screen, usually rear screen projection screen. So the material's soft. PVC on the ceiling, we pull it down to make a wall, pull it out to make a counter. Basically, it's a kind of push and pull system. We pull out the PVC taut enough so that it can hold products. Because this is a material that you usually use for rear screen projection, we don't have to light the shelves from outside inside. The space for the store is very small. It's barely 45 feet long, about 15 feet wide. So we knew we had to be able to use all the space we could possibly get. Anytime there's a non-structural wall, we removed the wall and made a curving glass alcove outside the door, so we get some extra space. Racks of hanging clothes are in this extra space outside the store. Operation number four, continuous surface, endless space. A kind of a prototype bench we made in 2001, a bench based on the model of a Möbius strip. A strip, by twisting, seems to have one side and the other side. The back of our bench twists to become the seat of the bench, twists to become the bottom of the bench. You could be sitting on one side of the circle, you move over a little bit, you're inside the circle. We, like a lot of other designers, at the end of the 90s, beginning of the zeros, have become, why are we so interested in a kind of topological space? Because a topological geometry contrasted to a Euclidean geometry is malleable, is changeable. A sphere is still a sphere, whether it's pushed in, whether it's stretched out. Maybe a good description of topological space is set a fly down on what seems to be the inside or the outside. The fly, without being lifted off, without flying, goes from inside and outside, inside to outside, and vice versa. So I think the reason a topological space appeals to a lot of designers is that it leads us to question notions of public. It's if one space is continuous to another, maybe certain changes are possible that aren't possible when you're dealing with a more fixed geometry. Operation number five, push and pull. A project we did in 2004 in Memphis. It's at a corner of a performing arts center in Memphis. I mean, what happened was that the performing arts center was designed. While it was being built, it was realized there was this leftover space in the corner. So we were asked to, can we do something with that space? Can we find a way to use it for people who might be able to use it during the performance events inside? Performing Arts Center, part of the building goes over this leftover space. So the way we started was, what if we stood under this overhang of the building? What if we could fling a liquid out into the air? but whatever we stand up. So we pull it down to make columns. At the same time, we can pull it up to make a funnel. Now that there's a funnel, light can come in, sunlight can come in the back of our minds was, this is a performing arts center. There are spotlights inside. Can we make spots of sunlight outside? At night, it's replaced by another funnel is pulled towards the entrance of the building. It lights the entrance. At the bottom of the columns, the structure folds to make seats so you can sit around the columns. But the columns are hollow, so you can go inside the columns. Both inside and outside is mirrored. So when you're inside the columns, the sky is being reflected down around the circular wall around you, so you're sitting inside a room of sky. Operation number 7, folding, embedding. A project we're working on now in the south of France, all village in the mountains. The mayor is concerned that the village is very connected to its space, but not at all connected to its time. So we got a kind of interesting message here. Can we bring the village into the 21st century? I would love to believe we can, but I would love to believe, the kind of architect, though we obviously haven't found a way to really do this. The architecture we really want to do is an architecture that couldn't have been built, couldn't have been designed, couldn't even have been thought of before the 21st century. We don't do that. We try, but we obviously aren't good enough to do that. The kind of architecture we really want to do is the architecture that isn't subservient to the kind of architecture where a person can come into a space, decide they want to sit down, lean against a wall, and the wall starts to become a chair. You don't need the chair anymore. You get up, the wall goes back. A movie called Dark City a few years ago did a version of that. Not so much controlled by people. People were subservient to it. Every time people were asleep, the city changed. Interesting plot. But we'd like people to change the city, not so much that it changes without your knowing it. Anyway, Beaumont is a village that exists in the mountains. It survives on farming. But because they're in the mountains, the mountain slopes have to be terraced to make farming possible. But maybe we can use this terracing as an idea for housing. So I want to show this project just as an idea of how we begin. Can we make houses on the slope? Half the house would be outside, half the house would be inside the slope. So because half the house is inside, it's warmer in the winter, cooler in the summer. So we can have long lines of houses. But we thought, well, that's too much like apartments. They wanted private houses. Maybe we could braid the long lines. Still maybe too long a line. Maybe we can make little clusters of houses. While we were seeing the site, since we're on a slope here, this is a natural place for an amphitheater. So he suggested, can we think of a public space? Think of an amphitheater. So we thought, okay, we have seats on the slope facing the stage, but then we thought, maybe it's too expected an idea of a stage. Now that we have a stage at the bottom hill, can we stretch the stage? Can we stretch the stage over the audience? So maybe there can now be more relationship, more conjunction between person supposedly on stage, person off stage. Operation number 8, stretch, tentacles and feelers and architect. This is the site of a skate park we designed a few years ago in San Juan. It was what's true for us is true for, I guess, a lot of designers. Most of our projects are not built. A lot of them we think are going to be built, but something happens. In this case, San Juan claimed that they were running. There were 3 existent high points on the site that we were given to make this skate park. There's a there's a pedestrian bridge over a restaurant. On one side of the pedestrian bridge is a cone-shaped hill. On the other side is a slope up to a plateau that looks out over the ocean. So the way we saw it was that it's as if the skate park was already there. Since skating exists from going from a high point down to a low point, get enough impetus, go to the next high point, we thought all we had to do was fit out the existing high points. So one of our was we didn't want pedestrians to be isolated from skaters. We wanted skaters to always be walking under pedestrians to be walking beside skaters, under skaters. So there are snake runs on either side of the pedestrian ramp. On one side, the ramps go to the cone-shaped hill. Rather than laying over the hill, they go inside the hill. So the bowls of our skate park are in the interior of the hill. On the other side, the ramps step up, making what skateboarders call street elements, step up, then at the top of the plateau, the ramps become quarter pipes and half pipes going out onto the ocean. There's one other example of an architecture of landscape, an architecture of tentacles and feelers. A proposal we made a few years ago for a library in Guadalajara. We started with a plaza that stepped down, rebuilding steps up. It had been mentioned in the brief that there needed to be an expansion system in the library, more books, etc. But we thought maybe we could take that more literally. There was a highway nearby, so we thought maybe our library can step up, but also step out. And in other words, we began with a very simple idea. Books are dangerous. You know, books should allow you to leave home, go into the rest of the city. Operation number 9, braid, not weave. This was a new lighting system we proposed for New York a few years ago. The brief is a very large, very thick pole, because the brief said that these poles had to hold different kinds of lights, different kinds of signs. We thought maybe the brief was misplaced, since all these different signs and lights weren't going to be used on every occasion. So we thought, let's try the opposite approach. Let's have possible. Each pole will hold one kind of light, one kind of sign. So the more lights, the more signs you need, you would braid and weave posts together so that they would range from very thin to very gnarled snarl of posts. Operation twist, warp, morph. A person-made island we did in 2003 in Graz in Austria. We were asked to use the River Mure that runs through the city as a place for this person-made island. The island was to have three functions: a theater, a cafe, and the playground. We're thinking of a conventional shape for a theater, a bowl. What if we twist the bowl? What if we turn the bowl upside down? Now we have a dome. So the bowl is the theater, the dome is the cafe, the roof of the cafe, the twisting space from bowl to dome and vice versa is the playground. It's lit at night. Light comes up from under the bleachers of the theater. Light comes down from the roof of the cafe. Here we're in the cafe. We knew it wasn't always going to be used officially as a cafe. We wanted it to be used as a public space when it wasn't being used for theater. Therefore, we built the seats in ways. Seats were straight. Everybody's sitting next to each other, facing straight ahead, as if at an airport, as if at a theater. If the seat is in waves, there's the possibility of person-to-person seating. Bowl is twisting to become a dome. People entering the dome, the cafe. Same principles inside. Above the doorway is a canopy. that twists and comes down to make lounge seating around the cafe. There's also movable seating, seats and tables for two that can be put together for four people, for six people. They can be stacked. Above our bar is a rubber band and comes down, twists, and separates into multiple bar counters. When we're trying to do a space, we try to think of the possible parameters of activity in the space. There's a bar here. What about the person who's had maybe too much to drink? The person is holding a glass. The person can't see. Counters probably wherever you put your hand, you'll probably hit the bar counter. Operation number 11: adapt, change, modify a chameleon architecture. Back to the coffee tea set. The way it works is in the transparent sections between the sugar units, there are cups and saucers. So you take the cups and saucers out. This spheroid has four flat points. You roll it to one flat point. Now it's stable. You push your glass inside. Push it up. Now you have coffee. Move the sphere to another flat point. Put your cup inside. Now you have. Hopefully you don't have tea, but you push it to the right place and have milk, sugar, etc. I want to go through some of these things, maybe more quickly. An attempt we made for an ideas company, plaza in Strasbourg. All these projects are within the last three years or so. We wanted to make a plaza that would be always changing. So there were these arcs across which roofs and canopies could move. The arcs also provided lighting. There's them on the floor, so you can always move chairs, move one chair next to another chair, move tables together to make a kind of marketplace, move chairs together to make a stage. Another example of a changeable space, which again is, as I mentioned, lines, though we've never done it well enough, I think. I mean, the problem is, yes, we can build principles for change, but what if people want to change something else? You know, they can only change the changing systems we have provided. So sometimes I think that all we do is supermarket freedom. You know, you can have anything you wanted as long as the supermarket carries it. You can do anything you want as long as we have allowed for that kind of change. Back to the Bologna Sommaire project, the trajectory through the fishing port. At one point, the trajectory goes across a body of water. So, and we've designed a bridge that doubles as a restaurant. At the left, there's a long counter. At the right, tables and chairs. This body of water is a lock, so ships have to come in. When the ships come in, the bridge has to retract. We're working with engineer Bureau Happold, and we've come up with a system that when the bridge retracts, people don't have to leave the bridge. So when a ship comes in, the bridge starts to coil up, so it's to wind up like a snake. It's still a bridge, but it used to be a linear bridge. Now it's a kind of another part of this fishing port. Is supposed to be a park. We thought a park near the ocean should be different from a park on dry land. So our beginning proposal is to use a pipe system to bring water underground. The tide here changes about 30 feet. So what the water underground makes the furniture of the park always different. At the right of the slide is low tide, so there's an amphitheater in the ground. In the middle of the slide is is mid-tide. Now there's no amphitheater. Left of the slide, amphitheater pushed up by comes up off the ground. Operation number 12, portable architecture, mobile architecture. We've been talking about doing clothing for a long time. Clothing is obviously the first architect. Skin covers the bones, then clothing covers the skin. We've made some initial attempts. A little fashion magazine called The Black Book asked us a year and a half or so ago, proposed to us that the umbrella hasn't been redesigned in years. Could we propose a new umbrella? So we started in clothing, kind of pleating system. So we made something that we called an umbrella. It's made of a kind of two-way mirrored mylar, so it can act as a kind of camouflage as you are walking in the city. You can see out, but because of the change of light, the outside is over an already existent umbrella. You can tie one end to your wrist, one end to your waist, so your hands are free. You can wrap it around you like a kind of cloak, so there's not the problem of bumping umbrellas. You can wrap another person. Ruffles, and this is what we haven't figured out well enough yet, the ruffles allow a folding system. Ideally, it should fold to something as large as your fist. So far, we've done it as probably as large as your arm. So, another thing we've been working on is an attempt at a new car, a car that wouldn't need tires. It's based on a science, or maybe a pseudoscience, called cymatics, where the insertion of sound into a plane makes the plane ripple and wave. The ripple and wave causes motion. We've kind of proven to ourselves that we can get something to move approximately 12 miles an hour, but we haven't gone beyond that yet. We want a soft car, almost taking the idea of airbags and exaggerating it into a car, based on the principle that maybe the way to face impact is not by resisting it, but by bending with it, flowing with it. We want to do cars that every once in a while can join together, because not everybody wants to drive all the time. So one of her and the cars are turned into a kind of bus. Operation number 13, emergence, growth, architecture from the bottom up, architecture from inside out. Another thing I think that certainly joins us with the architects we pay attention to and admire is that everybody wants an architecture that grows, you know, wants to make an architecture that's, you know, like biology. Somebody's going to figure out how to do it. We've only done it really in metaphor. This was a bus stop we proposed a few years ago. If it was for a site with a tree, we started with making a kind of vase around the tree. Vase, it expands. It's another topological figure called a torus. The vase expands into a kind of umbrella, so it protects you from rain and snow. In the meantime, where the tree is, it's raining and snowing on the tree, around the tree. We're working on a project in India, based on this, maybe based more less metaphorically on the notion of emergence and swarm. We're trying to design a light system. We're designing a roadway that goes through a garage. The garage would be a volume of light, maybe a different color each time of day. Then when a person walks through it, or drives through it, or cycles through it, there's this network of lights around the person, and there's what lights. Oops, sorry. No, I didn't mean to do that. Sorry, I don't know if I can get it back. Maybe not. But anyway, as you're walking through, you light certain lights depending on what direction you're walking in. As one person encounters another person, the lights keep changing. So the lights are determined by the people using the place. Operation number 14, like a parasite, like a virus. I think we, like a lot of architects now, or even though Blade Runner was a long time ago, I think architects' frame of mind was by Blade Runner. I know for me, it changed my notion of science fiction away from Stanley Kubrick's all white, all abstract 2001 to the notion of you're never going to have enough money to begin from the beginning. You have to build on what's already there. So the notion of architecture as a parasite, I think, is something that always in our mind. This was a rejected proposal we made for a subway station in New York. Nicholas Grimshaw was the architect. Now his station isn't going to be built anyway. But he had designed a building in the shape of a dome. The result of the dome was there's a high atrium inside. You know, impressive spaces, grand spaces. They always give me a funny feeling. It seems like there's all that space there, but no space for people. They're all that space up there. People are down here. So we proposed that we would kind of turn this dome in on itself. As a result, we hang the atrium in the middle, so light still comes in and down. But around the edges is this vertical park, so people can walk up, spiral up the edges of the dome. Last operation, mix, swarm, molt. Back to the World Trade Center project. Now that we have this building riddled with holes, now the rest of the city can come inside. Parks can come inside the building. Street vendors can come inside the building. In other words, instead of observing the convention of a private building with a so-called public space in temp, as I think it is in all of our projects, at least if our projects come close to working, our attempt is to mix public and private.
Please join us at Slot Foundation.